life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. We want to talk this week about the topic of nursing homes. We know that many of our listeners, some themselves may be in nursing homes, but if not, we suspect that many of you know someone, a close family member probably, that is in some sort of long-term care facility. So we thought we'd take a few minutes and talk about first, you know, what is a nursing home and how is it distinguished as a label from all these other types of housing that we hear used? And then to talk about some changes that have occurred in the last recent decades, I'll say, and then some very recently that assure a lot of protections that didn't exist at one time for the people that were in nursing homes.
I know as I was growing up, there was kind of a stigma with being in a long-term care facility. When I was younger, we would often go to nursing homes to maybe sing your carol at Christmas time, and you would walk in and you would feel immediately uncomfortable.
They
sometimes
were dreary places.
They were. They were not necessarily places that you wanted to go. But that has changed over the years. Well, and a lot of nursing facilities now will have kind of a continuation of care. They are divided more in neighborhoods. They'll have kitchen facilities available, or they just are much more pleasant than they ever used to be. And a lot of that is due to some of these changes that have taken place over the last several years.
Yeah, the industry has grown, and I think there's been some competition in the industry that's very healthy. The substantial majority of nursing homes in America are for-profit, meaning they're operated by companies who have stockholders or single proprietors, and the bottom line is the owners want to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think that often it can result in superior service, and in many cases does, although not in all.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to talk a little bit. So let me kind of back up a little bit and talk a little bit about some of these labels. We hear the phrase nursing home. Nursing home is sometimes referred to in formal language as a skilled care facility.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of skilled care. There's intermediate skilled care, and then there's what's called traditional skilled care. Short of that is short of that are things like assisted living facilities or residential care facilities. Now, those are regulated more by state law than federal law. Federal law is what governs nursing homes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in order to qualify for Medicare or Medicaid, which, as you might imagine, is a huge source of revenue for the vast majority of nursing homes, not all, but the vast majority, then they want to comply with those requirements. And there are a few other federal statutes that impose requirements. So separate from that, though, are the various categories that exist on a state level. And on a state level, you can have residential care in Missouri, for example, which is a lower level of service than you would find in an assisted living facility. An assisted living facility is required to offer certain things, such as, for example, there would be a nurse that might be on duty so many hours a day or so many hours per week. A residential care facility has no nursing requirements. There might be medication assistance with provision of medication in an assisted living as opposed to the administration of medication, which would occur in a skilled care facility. So it seems like a subtle distinction, but it's important. It means that someone who operates a assisted living facility doesn't have to have on duty skilled nurses or certified nurses that are on duty 24/7 to deal with issues such as medication, which by their nature are 24/7 sorts of issues. So an assisted living facility can instead have someone there who provides assistance with medication, meaning they might hold it out for the person. They might remind the person. They may let them know they need to take it. But it's strictly from the position that something that could be lawfully done by someone who's not a nurse.
So, in other words, it might be something where they can help you, remind you, do all those things that you might do if you had the time or the ability or the resources, but they can't necessarily administer the drugs.
That's correct. For example, through a hypodermic needle or through an IV, et cetera. So, yeah, that's correct. So assisted living and residential care are categories that are subject to state law. We're not going to focus on those today. We want to focus on skilled care facilities or long-term care facilities that are subject to federal law, because that is where there really is a lot of teeth in the legislation that many people, I suspect, don't realize that their loved ones are entitled to the sort of care that they are. This has become a big business. So it means that a nursing home needs to have on available to them, reviewing their documents, lawyers and others who can assure that they comply with this legislation. And the legislation is substantial. It was originally passed in 1987 through the Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act. And that was in response to some of you are old enough, many of you, I suspect, are old enough to remember the allegations that existed in the 60s and in the 70s and coming to a head in the early 80s, that there was neglect occurring where people, their loved ones might sit in fecal matter, for example. You'd hear these awful
horror stories.
Yeah, where people were not given attention. They were simply warehoused, more or less, in these very industrial environments. And many of you have walked through these facilities where they're cold, sterile, not at all with a residential feel. Those tile floors, I can remember seeing those in where I grew up in Appalachia in a local nursing home, and cement block walls, and I mean, just very, very institutional. And under those conditions, there were a lot of violations to the dignity, to the sort of quality of care that all of us would expect for those we care about. And it was routine, and it wasn't something that occurred just occasionally in extreme cases. That was almost the standard in some parts of the country. So thankfully, advocates came along. There was legislation. There were hearings first in Washington. Some will recall those hearings, and out of those came lots of information that kind of appalled the public, and they finally recognized that action needed to be taken. So it was, and the Nursing Home Reform Act was incorporated in the Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act of 1987. So since then, though, there have been a few updates to that. But let's talk about it comprehensively, because I know that there are still lots of nursing homes who are not complying with this legislation, and the consequences are substantial. I mean, they can lose their right to receive any sort of funding of Medicaid or Medicare, and that is a concern for anybody who has these facilities. So what we want to do is talk about some of these requirements, and those of you who have loved ones or even who are looking at nursing homes, you might ask yourselves, are these things being met for you or your loved ones?
Yeah, I think that it's good to remind ourselves that there is a higher standard. It's okay to say, you know what, this is what my loved one would like. This is what my loved one needs. And it is okay to ask for that. And that's one of those changes that came about because of this Reform Act.
Yeah, and it attacks all of, I think, the major concerns that people have had, those categories of concerns that they've had, and we'll kind of walk through those. Let's start by talking about the quality of care. There was concern that people, when they went into a nursing home, they were no longer treated as they might have been, for example, if they were in a hospital. Well, some of that is because the nature of their conditions are different. Keep in mind what qualifies someone for care in a long-term care facility. That means that their condition is such that, for the most part, it's not a place for treatment. It's not a place where you go to recover from something, with the exception of rehab. Sometimes people will be transferred from a hospital to what's called a long-term care facility for purposes of rehabilitation. And I get that. So those cases, people are there temporarily. They're expected to improve and move on. Incidentally, if that doesn't occur, if there's not that progress, then Medicare will no longer pay for that.
Right.
Some listening to the show may think, well, gee, I know that Medicare covers some occasions when people are in long-term care facilities. And the reason that that's happening is because that's a place where they can go to less expensively than they would have had in a hospital. Mm-hmm. And in that facility, they're intended to get the sort of rehab, as the term implies, in which they're going to get better and they'll be on their own or sent home. That's the reason you have that 100-day limitation mm-hmm. per spell of illness that's applicable to Medicare. So the 100 days envisions a period of time when they're on their own. And keep in mind, the 100 days is not paid entirely by Medicare. The first 20 days is paid entirely, and the last 80 days, I think, is now at 80%. But the point is, it's not 100%.
Hmm.
So
good to know.
Yeah, with the exception of those rehab circumstances, for the most part, these long-term care facilities are not places you go for treatment mm-hmm. of an illness or injury. That's hospitals. Instead, these are places where people have sort of custodial care needs. They have chronic conditions. Perhaps maybe they've just reached a status in life where they're simply no longer capable of caring for themselves. So if they meet what's called three of the ADLs, activities of daily living, are these crucial criteria that are so influential in a lot of ways.
Okay, give us what those are. Can you run through most
well,
of those?
I may shake it up on one or two because the list varies a little bit between federal and state regulations and among agencies. And there's also an instrumental activities of daily living, which it adds two or three more prongs, in some cases four prongs, to these five. So let's walk through generally what people will need to demonstrate to be able to qualify for Medicaid, for example, to be paid in long-term care facility, or incidentally for their own insurance,
mm-hmm.
which, and again, they may vary these a little bit because some will include what's called these instrumental ADLs. But a big one is transferring. Can they on their own transfer from a bed to a chair or from a chair to a bed? Transferring is a big deal because mm-hmm. we know in order to avoid the decubitus or bed sores and other issues that can happen from that immobility, we need people to be able to independently transfer to and from home if they're going to live on their own at home. So if they need assistance with those, that's an activity of daily living. Bathing, of course, that's pretty self-explanatory.
Mm-hmm.
Toileting. A little separate from toileting is incontinence. The instrumental activities of daily living will include things like cooking.
Okay.
But assistance with eating would be an original ADL. In other words, something where you can't simply eat on your own. Sometimes there are problems associated with that or the drink, whether mm-hmm. it's your ability to hold or pour, et cetera.
Well, I'm thinking of like a Parkinson's or something where
yeah.
I've actually seen some people who really have trouble even holding a glass to drink
yeah.
something.
And there are so many things like that may seem like someone's functional in some ways, but when you look at these ADLs, then you realize that these are very fundamental things that if you're left on your own to do those, you can't do them.
Mm-hmm.
So typically there's a requirement for Medicaid purposes of three ADLs. So once someone's met those, and I'll be frank with you, it's not too difficult to meet those if people really are very old and very frail and have the challenges, which we all know come with those things.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a test that people regularly fail who are looking for care at that age. But in any case, that is required to demonstrate to go into long-term care and have insurance or another party, governmental, public resources to pay. Now, here, though, is what people should think about whenever they're looking at a nursing home or they're evaluating the quality of care that a loved one is receiving. Let's start with the quality of care itself. So we know that as we just discussed, it's not about so much treatment, but we do know there are things that have to happen regularly. So any change in condition, any change in condition. This is required in the Nursing Home Reform Act, and it also has been stiffened with some modifications that were made under Obama in 2015, which went into effect. These are three phases of amendment to the Nursing Home Reform Act that occurred, passed in 2015, when first phase went into effect in 2016, second phase in 2017, and then a third phase is set for 2019.
Yeah, I think it's 16, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, 16, 17, and 19.
19, they skipped 18.
It did. And I will tell you that the schedule of the implementation of these reforms were slowed down by the Trump administration. That will not surprise some of you, even many of you who are fans of Trump, his objective, I think, is to reduce the costs and make it practical for people to pay for long-term care. And some of these requirements that were enhanced by Obama in 2015, which incidentally was on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of Medicare and Medicaid, some of these enhancements were onerous. And in nursing homes whose experts testified in these congressional hearings that it was difficult, if impossible, for them to be profitable and meet some of these requirements, then that, I think, has resulted in some relief that has occurred or delay that has occurred in the implementation of some of these additional requirements under Obama. But I'll tell you that if you look at the substance of what was passed in 1987 under the original Nursing Home Reform Act, that they're substantial. Mm-hmm. And it's really a matter of enforcement. These that have occurred more recently with Obama relate more to quality of life factors than they do the sort of substance of care. The substance of care was intended to address those most immediate things where people were being neglected or catheters were not being changed properly, bandages where people had a turn in their condition that wasn't responded to appropriately, where there were policies that were in effect, I can tell you, in many nursing homes up until 2013. It was a standard policy, unless there was provision otherwise, they did not do CPR on a patient in a nursing home.
Oh, is that right?
In other words, the default position was not to do CPR. That was default. So unless you had gone to the trouble to communicate very clearly your expectation that you wanted to live, then the assumption was you wanted to die.
Wow.
And that changed in 2013. Now I can tell you that across the country, anybody, Medicare, Medicaid, any sort of federal funds, then there's not the presumption that they won't do it. There's a presumption that they will, unless there's, in effect, a DNR, do not resuscitate, which is issued by the doctor, or there's a living will, or a health care directive more generally, which will specify specifically something else. And you would think that would be the default position rather
right.
than this is a place, which that's consistent with the warehouse mentality. Mm-hmm. This is a place where we go to sort of provide the basic support to these people till they die.
Right.
We warehouse them till they die. So there was that philosophy, and it was embedded in that position regarding CPR. But anyway, so the original focus in the legislation passed in 87 was really on those fundamental substantive physical care issues.
And treating people with dignity.
And dignity.
And that's kind of what it comes down to.
Dignity, yes. But I can tell you that really gained momentum, though, in these more recent amendments that occurred under Obama. But you're right, dignity is inherent in those fundamental care positions. So here's the things, though, that I'll suggest, starting from the time that you have a loved one who will enter a long-term care facility, or maybe you're asking questions. They have an obligation, if they're receiving any federal funds, they have an obligation to do an assessment plan within 48 hours of someone coming in. An assessment plan means identifying all the components of their care and needs, information about medicine, information about walking or physical conditions that they require, any dietary information, any information that relates directly to their health and care is what would be called the client or patient assessment. Now, the assessment is to be incorporated into what's called a comprehensive care plan. Now, the comprehensive care plan, I think they have certainly less than a week,
okay.
And it may be 5 days. But keep in mind, on the outer limits, like a week, there should be a comprehensive care plan in place. That comprehensive care plan, which now incorporates, I'm incorporating some of these new requirements that came into existence after 2015, that new comprehensive care plan should include questions about quality of life, about what are the individual goals of that patient, what are reasonable expectations of that patient, what are individual preferences and values of that patient. These are kind of the intangibles. Mm-hmm. These are the things that if you have Maslow's this hierarchy of need, some people that'll ring a bell from college. Anyway, it's where, you know, on the lower levels of this pyramid, you think about survival,
right?
Food, shelter, medical care, if it existed. You know, those are kind of that those lower tier things. Once all those things are met, the real quality of life stuff, you'll remember from your college, if you had any of these classes, related to the things like value, mm-hmm. and meaning and desires and purpose. So those things now are sort of incorporated in this more sophisticated expectation that emerged with 2015. For the most part, I'll make a confession here. I hope I don't lose any of my audience, but I'm not a big fan of Obama. But there are some things he did that I applaud. And this would be one of them? This would be one of them. So I think that people now, when they're considering a nursing home for themselves or for their loved ones, and they're evaluating it, they should look for, you know, is this assessment plan a part of the routine of admission? And that should occur very quickly. Again, no later than 48 hours there should be such a plan in place.
So if that has not happened within 48 hours, you have every right to say, we need to have a meeting to discuss this plan, to try and get this there, to get the assessment? Or is that a question you ask going in and say, do you do this?
Well,
and if not?
That's the more subtle thing, you know? In other words, it's not so much a lawyer thing to answer. It's a practical thing. And I'll tell you, as a lawyer, the requirement's there. Yes, you can ask about it. And yes, they have a duty to respond. And furthermore, you can report it. It's something that would constitute a violation, and the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is the agency to which you would report these violations, would follow up and investigate. It wouldn't qualify as a violation under state law as a sort of abuse, neglect, or exploitation. We'll talk about that in a minute. But it would qualify as something that would be an expectation that you have entitled to be met, because it is a requirement. It's a prong of requirements. So it wouldn't be good for them to have to deal with a complaint relating to that.
Right.
So I think I would ask the question, tell me, what sort of assessment do you do when we come in? Do you have a process for that? Tell me how that works. And what about, you can use the phrase, this will impress them, if you say, but is there a comprehensive care plan that's done? And when is that done? They'll know you've done a little bit of research when you start asking these questions, but they're fair questions.
Mm-hmm.
And incidentally, in fairness to nursing homes, I think many of them will be ready for that. They know this stuff. Believe me, as we mentioned a while ago, they have lawyers that have been giving symposia on this to all their leaders. So they know these requirements because they've been confronted with them. So when they go in now, they have to meet not just these fundamental care issues about your medicine and when you need to take it and physical limitations and constraints and activities that you require individually, but now you've stepped up to that higher sort of parts of the pyramid where they should be talking about what your expectations are. Believe it or not, one of the questions that they should be asking in this latter category is, what are your goals? Is your goal to go home?
Hmm.
And so, you know, I kind of think, well, it should be obvious that their goal would have been to go home if they could, but it's
right.
Probably not realistic. But some people do come with the expectation, and some realistically, that they'll return home.
Mm-hmm.
And if they know that, then that will affect how they proceed. It will affect what they do and when they do it. In other words, this shouldn't be simply a therapy session
right.
for their new resident. It's not about this sort of discussion. It's about tangible results. So goals are to be a part, incorporated, and drive in many ways the comprehensive care plan. And also there will be discussions about, what do you want to happen if your heart stops?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want an intervention? Now, many people will have separately a document, and they'll be asked, do you have an advanced care directive already? Do you have a durable power of attorney for health care? So they'll want to know these things, and they'll incorporate in the record. But certainly that will be a part of a comprehensive care plan, which, again, is something that should be completed in less than a week from the time that that you or your loved one has entered this facility. The other piece is living out the plan. You know, once you know what the plan is for you or your loved one, is this being carried out? Are the things happening that are intended to produce that result? Let's move to another category here, which is addressed there because we have such limited time. Should we take a break now?
I think we should take a break.
All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back in a second.
Listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors, presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors, and now attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Okay, we're back. So let's continue with talking about what is it reasonable for you to expect? What does the law require of a nursing home in which you or a loved one may reside? I want to talk about this Nursing Home Reform Act as it relates to safety issues. I can tell you that among the more challenging problems that many of these facilities face is what's called wandering and elopement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many of you are thinking, well, wait, I know what wandering is, but I don't know what elopement as it applies to this. Is this that nursing home residents run off and get married?
You've heard of that. I mean, I have heard of nursing home residents getting married.
Well, that's not what I'm talking about here.
Probably not, though.
Well, the fact is that in nursing homes, among the biggest challenges they face is the tendency of people as they age, especially with some dementia, mm-hmm. to wander or to elope. Now, let me define these terms. Wandering refers to the sort of unintentional, sometimes it's called motor activity, but it means walking about.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not conscious. It's not purposeful. It's just walking about. So that person, what are the problems that can produce? Well,
right.
We can think of a few of those.
Right. I know in the past we've had some guests who have talked about, especially with dementia, that people are up at all different times of the night, and that's just what they do. They're just walking.
Yeah, yeah. And if they're in a facility that's designed for that purpose, and we know, as that guest was with such a facility, we know that they're designed to accommodate these things.
Right.
I mean, they exist to anticipate the unique challenges of people with dementia. So they rarely have crises or mishaps occur like that in those facilities, those long-term care facilities, which are often called memory care facilities, for example. But in a traditional long-term care facility, they have to deal with people with dementia. It may be transient. It mm-hmm. might be that it's just some medication they're taking currently. It may be the result of an event they've had, a physical event they had, which they don't expect to continue. So nursing homes are more vulnerable. If they don't specialize in that, they're more vulnerable to that happening on a case-by-case basis, maybe people without a history of that even. So that's called wandering. Now, among the dangers is the person can wander into places maybe they shouldn't be. It could scare other patients.
Right.
They can harm themselves. They can fall. They can even wander out of the facility.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can tell you that from a liability standpoint, there aren't many defenses. When you look at litigation that's occurred relating to nursing homes, those cases that have involved wandering, there's not much you can say. The person has been placed in your care.
Right.
And they've either placed themselves or been placed in your care. And it's like a school saying they're not responsible for your child who does something, a very small child, who does something that injures themselves in the care of it's called in loco parentis or whatever, meaning they're the parents for the day, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And let me talk about the other term, very similar but different, and that's elopement. Elopement is also a problem for nursing homes. That's where someone, maybe they have dementia, but they intend to wander off, meaning their intention is to go. And we've perhaps have had loved ones who do that. They deliberately walk out of the house at night. It's not as if they're kind of wandering around. There's this door that's open, and they just kind of wander through the door. That's wandering. Wandering, incidentally, doesn't so often result in people leaving the ground. But I want to make a technical point here to where you understand it's possible to wander and still end up walking out the door of the facility. But elopement is where someone, often in some form of dementia at that moment at least, they leave the facility and they can go off anywhere. And they sometimes turn up at bus stations. They sometimes turn up wandering along roads.
Mm-hmm.
They can wander into roads in front of traffic. I mean, so, and of course you can with wandering too. So these terms, wandering and elopement, these are things that you want to know that this facility has precautions, depending especially if there are characteristics that perhaps your loved one has. These are things you specifically want to ask about, but it's also provided for in this legislation. So these are things for which they're held responsible. They have to anticipate. So if they believe that someone is vulnerable to that, what are the options? There are lots of options.
That's what I was just going to ask. What can they do?
Well, we know from the litigation. We know from the tort litigation. There are lawyers whose job it is to take these cases to court when things go south for the nursing home. And we know from the testimony of experts. There's a list of things they should have, could have done.
Mm-hmm.
Among them is putting in a camera.
Okay.
For those. When they know somebody is vulnerable to that, they should consider that. They can have locked doors. Now, not so much locking. Generally, you can brush up against other issues if you lock someone in their room. So generally, that means a nursing home may have an area that is a locked area, a ward. Sort. I won't use the word ward anymore, but it's an area for those people that might have this vulnerability.
Well, see, and then I'm thinking another code then would be a lot of times in big facilities, you have to have the panic door so you can get out in case there's a fire.
Good. That's an example, and it's been mentioned, yeah. There can be alarms set in various places. You can now place on a patient, the technology exists, to where when the patient moves, you know. And now it's very difficult for nursing homes to say what they might have said maybe 30 years ago, that, gee, we can't watch everybody all the time. Well, the fact is they can.
Mm-hmm.
And in any case, they're getting paid to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the standard they're held to. And these are things that you might have a concern about for your particular loved one. Elopement really is more of the same thing. It's just a little bit more of a challenge that someone will leave the facility, and you need to think more about that tendency. So that is going to relate to exterior doors and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Wandering can occur in so many ways where patients can be surprised, or it can traumatize patients, neighbors, and that's another expectation is safety from those sorts of events. If your loved one is staying in a facility and maybe they're the one who was sleeping in the night and they wake up to find someone over their bed, I mean, these sorts of things, they're assured protection from.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been there's been litigation about those safety issues that falls more under the category abuse, neglect, exploitation. Which I don't know that we'll have time to get into here, but that's a substantial section of the newer legislation as well as that existed in the old. And each of those terms have definition, but you want assurances that are protections against those things occurring. Let me mention another thing in the limited amount of time we have left. Fundamental to someone who is conforming with the Nursing Home Reform Act is a requirement that if there's any change in condition, a change in condition can mean anything such as an infection. Maybe someone who has had some sort of cardiac event.
Hmm.
It could be just a change in their vital signs that's substantial. Any change in their condition requires two things. It requires that their doctor be immediately, timely notification, which typically means immediate, meaning within hours, depending on the an hour. Depending on the nature of the particular urgency. But the other is to notify the loved one. Both those notifications have to happen.
Okay.
Now, some people think, okay, that's nice to know they're supposed to do that, but that's not something I would focus on. Well, maybe you should focus on that. I mean, it really is nice to know that if any change occurs with your loved one, you'll get a phone call. It may be at 2 o'clock in the morning, mm-hmm. and it may not be that important. But I think that all of us agree we'd rather get the phone call.
Well, I would think so. I mean, you want to be able to make those decisions. I mean, that you're put in that position, obviously, because your loved one is unable to. So you want to be able to make those decisions or ask those questions or be notified if, for example, certainly the change could be a permanent change.
It could. It could. And I'm sure many of those things that would be that would require notification will turn out to not be serious. And incidentally, you can waive those as a loved one. You can waive those. But I think most people want that. And it is, it's a requirement that's not obvious. I don't think people know that their nursing home has a duty to notify them on any significant change. And let me tell you, significant is defined, looking at the case law and the legislation and the congressional hearings, is defined very, very low, meaning a low bar.
So a drop in blood pressure.
Substantial drop. Yes. Yeah. Meaning that enough to where, according to the criteria of their condition,
right,
this would be considered a significant change.
Right.
So it is a little bit driven by medical standards.
How diligent do they have to be to notify you? I mean, leaving a message on a cell phone?
If that's all they have.
If that's all that they can get?
If that's what you've given them. You want to be sure that you've given them the right numbers. And then that you don't want them to be able to say, gee, we didn't have a number, or we didn't have this. We left a call, but oh, we didn't have, there was no opportunity to leave a message. So this, as well as the second piece, is they have to notify the doctor. And some people might think, well, this is obvious, but it's not obvious. I can tell you, in long-term care facilities, it's regarded as something that's not like a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
It's regarded as a place where people are sort of placed to stay until they die. And it's less about treatment and care and quality of life. I can tell you that attitude permeated the industry at one time. Less so today. I know people who work in the industry now would be offended if someone said that that's their attitude today. For the most part, that's not the attitude of the industry today. But it doesn't mean that the industry as a whole is complying with these requirements. So I do think that you have to insist that all of these criteria be met. Now, changing condition also triggers a requirement that prompt action be taken. So the implementation of whatever advice the doctor responded with, let's assume that the notification occurs.
Mm-hmm.
The notification, and you can check charts, people listening. Those of you who think your loved ones may not be getting the attention they need, you should ask. And there, you have access to their medical records, or you should if you have an authorization. And their medical records should show that when their condition changed in such and such a way, that there was within a close time period. I mean, there's not a, you know, this isn't a matter of a written rule somewhere, but it's a reasonableness standard. So you'd expect in less than an hour, certainly, depending
right.
on the nature. So you would see where there was a phone call made to the physician, and you'll see the physician responded in some way. It may have been do nothing. Okay, that's a fair, in some cases, that's the right response.
Right, monitor it. Yeah.
But in other cases, it will be do something. Well, look at the record. Was that done? If it was done, when was it done? Was it done 2 days later? So there's lots of things that can be put off that if you read the provisions of the statute, it would be a violation of the requirements of the Nursing Home Reform Act. So I think that many nursing homes can delay these things or treat them in a casual manner because people don't know. Maybe the person who's a resident, of course, they don't know. They may not even be conscious of
right.
of where they are and what their quality of care is. But even loved ones may not know these things. So if you don't know them, you don't insist on them.
I think there's a hesitancy to ask. I mean...
You don't want to offend.
You don't want to offend. I'm not skilled in nursing. I haven't been to school for that. I talk on the radio. You know, so I think that there is a little bit of a hesitancy to question someone. And I think we have to overcome that a little bit. It's like, you know, not in a snotty way or anything at all, but, you know, what time did that happen or when was that? Or can I look at those records? I mean, I think we have to overcome that a little bit just to make sure that our loved one is getting the care that they need.
Yeah, and another motivation people have for not act is fear of retaliation.
Right.
Meaning that they, if you're a resident, do you want to offend the person that's coming in and caring for you every day?
Right.
So I think that's part of the reason that a lot of these things go unreported is fear, certainly by a resident, but even family members thinking that, you know, if I offend these people, will my loved one, you know, feel the effects?
Mm-hmm.
But I would argue to you, as a lawyer, I can tell you it's probably the opposite.
then they're going to go out of their way to make sure they're taken care of well.
I could tell you, in this case, that old adage about the squeaky wheel. I think if you're the family, especially the family, I'd argue even the family more than the patient. Sometimes the patient doesn't have the credibility they should. That bugs me, too. Mm-hmm. The resident often is just condescended to, and in some cases they are not fully with it. So maybe their points and their arguments and their complaints in some cases may be less lucid. But incidentally, they still are not to be ignored. I can tell you under this newer legislation, you know, the desires and preferences of the patient, there's an obligation on the part of the nursing home, for example, even food preferences. If it's reasonable, then the expectation it'll be met.
Okay.
So there is a reasonable standard.
I was going to say, there has to be some level of it has to be reasonable, I guess.
There is. But those things like quality of life, wanting to attend to worship services and things like that, you know, many facilities can accommodate that, either in-house or by transportation. So for many, that is achievable. But the bottom line is you want to be sure that you insist as a family member on the quality of care that you know your loved one should have. I think that often is the most forceful and effective means of assuring compliance.
Can you change it once the person is in the facility? Let's say, for example, they want to be, we've talked before about being in the sunshine so many hours a day, but let's say they really wanted that, but now that they're a little older, they don't want to do that. They want to do something different. They want to be in the garden or something. Can you change it and have and demand or ask nicely?
Yes. The comprehensive care plan is something that is not just done once, meaning it may be created as a whole once, but it has to be updated at least once a year.
Oh, okay.
So there is this annual update, and more frequently if necessary, is the way the language of the statute reads, but at least annually. So these are occasions when changes in goals, which happen, you know, whether you're living in a nursing home or not, our goals and our desires and our preferences change. So that can happen there, and there should be documentation of that in that comprehensive care plan. That's another thing to inquire about, is to, given enough time, you'd like to see that such a plan exists. And you can ask.
And it actually is in writing.
Yeah, you can ask about those things. And you're entitled to know, especially if you have an authorization for access to that, which you'd be required other than the resident themselves. So these are things you should expect. One other thing, how much time do we have left here?
About 2 minutes.
Okay, just real quickly. A critical piece of this requirement of ongoing care is that things such as a decubitus or called a bed sore.
Okay.
When those things happen, that is almost conclusively, not conclusively, that's not fair, the vast majority of times that could have been prevented by moving them around, whether it's the vulnerable areas, the hip, the buttock area, that bony area there, as well as the heels. These are the places where these things occur. This is something that is suggestive. I won't say conclusively, but suggestive of a failure to give the sort of attention, take the sort of action, provide the sort of regular movement that is required for someone to avoid this. Often the infections, a urinary tract infection, is notoriously something where there wasn't adequate cleaning around or changing that might have occurred that could have prevented that. These are not conclusive, again, in fairness, but they're suggestive. They're a red flag that may be the sort of diligent care that this new legislation envisions is not occurring. So check for those things and ask about those things. Be persistent, and I think that pays rather than being the sort of nice, quiet, acquiescent patient or loved one that many choose to be. Well, time's up. Are we there?
We are out of time.
Okay. Let's take the next show. Let's talk more about this, because I did want to hit on a few other prongs in talking about nursing home expectations that you might have for you and your loved ones, because so many people now are shopping for this sort of care, and they need to be informed consumers in order to assure that they get the best care possible. All right, another episode of Elder Talk. Till next time, take care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.